Homesick at Home. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Homesick at Home by G.K. Chesterton.
One, seeming to be a traveler, came to me and said, "What is the shortest journey from one place to the same place?" The sun was behind his head, so that his face was illegible. "Surely," I said, "to stand still." "That is no journey at all," he replied. "The shortest journey from one place to the same place is round the world." And he was gone. White Wind had been born, brought up, married, and made the father of a family in the white farmhouse by the river. The river enclosed it on three sides like a castle. On the fourth side, there were stables, and beyond that, a kitchen garden, and beyond that, an orchard, and beyond that, a low wall, and beyond that, a road, and beyond that, a pine wood, and beyond that, a cornfield, and beyond that, slopes meeting the sky, and beyond that... But we must not catalogue the whole earth, though it is a great temptation. White Wind had known no other home but this. Its walls were the world to him, and its roof the sky. This is what makes his actions so strange. In his later years, he hardly ever went outside the door. And as he grew lazy, he grew restless, angry with himself and everyone. He found himself in some strange way weary of every moment, and hungry for the next. His heart had grown stale and bitter towards the wife and children whom he saw every day, though they were five of the good faces of the earth. He remembered, in glimpses, the days of his toil and strife for bread, when, as he came home in the evening, the thatch of his home burned with gold as though angels were standing there. But he remembered it as one remembers a dream. Now he seemed to be able to see other homes, but not his own. That was merely a house. Prose had got hold of him, the sealing of the eyes and the closing of the ears. At last something occurred in his heart. A volcano, an earthquake, an eclipse, a daybreak, a deluge, an apocalypse. We might pile up colossal words, but we should never reach it. 800 times the white daylight had broken across the bare kitchen as the little family sat at breakfast. And the 801st time, the father paused with the cup he was passing in his hand. "That green cornfield through the window," he said dreamily, "shining in the sun. Somehow it reminds me of a field outside my own home." "Your own home?" cried his wife. "This is your home." White Wind rose to his feet, seeming to fill the room. He stretched forth his hand and took a staff. He stretched it forth again and took a hat. The dust came in clouds from both of them. "Father," cried one child, "where are you going?" "Home," he replied. "What can you mean? This is your home. What home are you going to?" "To the white farmhouse by the river." "This is it." He was looking at them very tranquilly when his eldest daughter caught sight of his face. "Oh, he is mad," she screamed, and buried her face in her hands. He spoke calmly. "You are a little like my eldest daughter," he said, "but you haven't got the look, no, not the look which is a welcome after work." "Madam," he said, turning to his thunderstruck wife with a stately courtesy, "I thank you for your hospitality, but indeed I fear I have trespassed on it too long. And my home, father, father, answer me, is not this your home?" The old man waved his stick. "The rafters are cobwebbed, the walls are rain-stained, the doors bind me, the rafters crush me. There are littlenesses and bickerings and heart-burnings here behind the dusty lattices where I have dozed too long, but the fire roars and the door stands open. There is bread and raiment, fire and water, and all the crafts and mysteries of love. There is rest for heavy feet on the matted floor, and for starved heart in the pure faces, far away at the end of the world, in the house where I was born." "Where? Where?" in the white farmhouse by the river. And he passed out of the front door, the sun shining on his face, and the other inhabitants of the white farmhouse stood staring at each other. White Wind was standing on the timber bridge across the river, with the world at his feet, and a great wind came flying from the opposite edge of the sky, a land of marvelous pale golds, and met him. Some may know what that first wind outside the door is to a man. To this man it seemed that God had bent back his head by the hair and kissed him on the forehead. He had been weary with resting, without knowing that the whole remedy lay in sun and wind and his own body. Now he half believed that he wore the 7-leagued boots. He was going home. The white farmhouse was behind every wood and beyond every mountain wall. He looked for it as we all look for fairyland at every turn of the road. Only in one direction he never looked for it, and that was where, only 1,000 yards behind him, the white farmhouse stood up, gleaming with thatch and whitewash against the gusty blue of morning. He looked at the dandelions and crickets and realized that he was gigantic. We are too fond of reckoning always by mountains. Every object is infinitely vast as well as infinitely small. He stretched himself like one crucified in an uncontainable greatness. O God, who hast made me and all things, hear 4 songs of praise. 1 for my feet, that thou hast made strong and light upon thy daisies. 1 for my head, which thou hast lifted and crowned above the 4 corners of thy heaven. 1 for my heart, which thou hast made a heaven of angels singing thy glory. And 1 for that pearl-tinted cloudlet far away above the stone pines on the hill. He felt like Adam, newly created. He had suddenly inherited all things, even the suns and stars. Have you ever been out for a walk? The story of the journey of White Wind would be an epic. He was swallowed up in huge cities and forgotten. Yet he came out on the other side. He worked in quarries and in docks in country after country. Like a transmigrating soul, he lived in a series of existences, a knot of vagabonds, a colony of workmen, a crew of sailors, a group of fishermen. Each counted him a final fact in their lives, the great spare man with eyes like 2 stars, the stars of an ancient purpose. But he never diverged from the line that girdles the globe. On a mellow summer evening, however, he came upon the strangest thing in all his travels. He was plodding up a great dim down that hid everything, like the dome of the earth itself. Suddenly, a strange feeling came over him. He glanced back at the waste of turf to see if there were any trace of boundary, for he felt like one who has just crossed the border of Elfland. With his head a belfry of new passions, assailed with confounding memories, he toiled on the brow of the slope. The setting sun was raying out a universal glory. Between him and it, lying low on the fields, there was what seemed to his swimming eyes a white cloud. No, it was a marble palace. No, it was the white farmhouse by the river. He had come to the end of the world. Every spot on earth is either the beginning or the end, according to the heart of man. That is the advantage of living on an oblate spheroid. It was evening. The whole swell of turf on which he stood was turned to gold. He seemed standing in fire instead of grass. He stood so still that the birds settled on his staff. All the earth and the glory of it seemed to rejoice round the madman's homecoming. The birds on their way to their nests knew him. Nature herself was in his secret, the man who had gone from one place to the same place. But he leaned wearily on his staff. Then he raised his voice once more. O God, who hast made me and all things, hear 4 songs of praise. 1 for my feet, because they are sore and slow now that they draw near the door. 1 for my head, because it is bowed and hoary now that thou crownest it with the sun. 1 for my heart, because thou hast taught it in sorrow and hope deferred that it is the road that makes the home. and one for that daisy at my feet. He came down over the hillside and into the pine wood. Through the trees he could see the red and gold sunset settling down among the white farm buildings and the green apple branches. It was his home now, but it could not be his home till he had gone out from it and returned to it. Now he was the prodigal son. He came out of the pine wood and across the road. He surmounted the low wall and tramped through the orchard, through the kitchen garden, past the cattle sheds. And in the stony courtyard, he saw his wife drawing water.
End of Homesick at Home by G.K. Chesterton.
On Losing One's Head. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Paula Santa. On Losing One's Head by G.K. Chesterton.
When I was a little boy, I had an imagination, though this has long been washed out of me by the wordy abstractions of politics and journalism. For imagination, real imagination, is never a vague thing of vistas. Real imagination is always materialistic, for imagination consists of images, generally graven images. There is a mad literalism about imagination, and when I had it, I turned everything that anyone mentioned into a concrete body and a staring shape. Thus, I would hear grown-up people using ordinary proverbs and figures of speech. Pale, worn-out proverbs, battered and colorless figures of speech. But every one of those phrases sprang out of me as fierce and vivid as a motto written in fireworks. For some reason, I had a particularly graphic visual concept in the case of nautical metaphors. Thus, when I heard that my uncle on a sea voyage had got his sea legs, I pictured the most horrible bodily transformations in my uncle. Had my uncle now got four legs? Or had it been necessary for his two original and, to my eye, unobjectionable legs to be amputated by the ship's doctor? Did the new legs arrive as sort of extra luggage, or did they loathsomely grow upon him, like hair or fungoids, with all the awful unnaturalness of nature? I pictured my uncle's sea legs as two green and glittering members, covered with scales like fishes, and bearing some resemblance to the two fish tails with which exuberant Renaissance artists sometimes provided tritons and mermaids. Again, when I heard, in some seafaring connection, that the captain kept his weather eye open, I assumed with faultless infantile logic that he kept the other one quite shut. And in some dreams, I rather pictured the captain's weather eye as being some separate and eccentric kind of eye, like that of a cyclops, an eye of blue sky or lightning that opened suddenly in his hat, or his coattails, and blazed through black fantastic tempests, a strange star of the storm. But there were many cases, even among more terrestrial and commonplace metaphors, where the material metaphor photographed itself on my fancy. One of them was the phrase about a man losing his heart. A man, considered as a material envelope, seemed so securely done up that how the heart could get out of the body was a problem analogous to that of how the apple could get into the dumpling. Perhaps, I mused, the phrase about a man having his heart in his mouth might throw some light on the somewhat revolting phrase, which spoke of a man with his heart in his boots, where there was clearly no thoroughfare. From this, my childish taste turned with a certain relief to the easier and more popular picture of a man losing his head, which seemed the sort of thing that might happen to anybody. Indeed, by this dream of symbolic decapitation, I was much haunted in infancy, and am not infrequently inspired and comforted even to this day. Whatever other metaphors may mean, this metaphor of the lost head has some primary and poetic meaning, and I have written many bad poems, bad fairy tales, and bad epilogues in my industrious attempt to find it out and declare it. The connection between the animal and intellectual meaning of it became close and even confused. I vaguely thought of Charles I as having lost his head equally in both senses, which is not perhaps wholly untrue. When I read of the miracle of St. Denis, who carried his head in his hand, it seemed to me quite a soothing and graceful proceeding, like a gentleman carrying his hat in his hand. St. Denis did not lose his head anyhow. He carried it in his hand as so not to lose it, as ladies do their ridiculous handbags. Indeed, this drifting and dancing dream of decapitation, in which kings and saints figured with Gothic fantasticality, had some kind of allegory in the core of it. The separation of body and head is a sort of symbol that the separation of body and soul, which is made by all the heresies and sophistries, which are the nightmares of the mind. The mere materialist is a body that has lost its head. The mere spiritualist is a head that has mislaid its body. Under the same symbol can be found the old distinction between the sinner and the heretic, about which theology has uttered many paradoxes, more profitable to study than some modern people fancy. For there is one kind of man who takes off his head and throws it in the gutter, who dethrones and forgets the reason that should be his ruler and witness. And the horrible headless body strides away over cities and sanctuaries, breaking them down and treading them into mire and blood. He is the criminal. But there is another figure equally sinister and strange. This man forgets his body, with all its instinctive honesties and recurrent sanities and laws of God. He leaves his body working in the fields like a slave, and the head goes away to think alone. The head, detached and dehumanized, thinks faster and faster like a clock gone mad. It is never heated by any generous blood, never softened by any healthy fatigue, never checked or warned by any of the terrible toxins of instinct. The head thinks because it cannot do anything else, because it cannot feel or doubt or know. This man is the heretic, and in this way all the heresies were made. The anarchist goes off his head, and the sophist goes off his body. I will not renew the old dispute about which is the worse amputation, but I should recommend the prudent reader to avoid both.
End of On Losing One's Head by G. K. Chesterton.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.